This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may be the State of the Union Day, but this week Americans are more caught up in the state of the president's sex life and whether or not he lied about it. Along with the facts, we've been exposed to gossip and rumors. My guest, Gail Collins, is the author of a book on gossip, celebrity, and American politics called Scorpion Tongues. It will be published in early spring. Collins serves on the New York Times editorial board and wrote a recent op-ed piece called The Long History of Presidential Sex Scandals. I asked her what she thinks is the closest parallel to the current media, political, and legal examinations of the president's sex life.
It depends on what part of it. The basic thing about this particular crisis of presidential confidence, I guess, is that every piece of it has happened before, but they've never all happened at the same time, and it's certainly never this fast. There have been presidents before who have been involved in sex in the White House, who, as far as we know, did indeed have affairs. In the case of Jack Kennedy, multiple encounters in the White House. There have been presidents who have been under incredible attack for their sex life during campaigns. There have been presidents who have been yapped at by the press about their private life throughout their presidency in incredibly personal ways. But we've never had one guy have all these things happen to him at the same time. I think probably in terms of a president who suffered the most from the media following and looking into his personal life, you had to go with Grover Cleveland, who just went through absolute torture especially during his first presidential campaign, in which outrageous things were said about his personal life. And unlike Bill Clinton, Grover Cleveland was a very unresilient kind of guy who was very starchy, very private. It must have been incredible torture for him.
What were the allegations?
It started out with an illegitimate child who popped up, who Cleveland had taken responsibility for. After much pain and effort, my researcher and I decided we didn't really think it was his illegitimate child, but he did take responsibility for it, and he did refuse to let anybody talk about it. But after that, that burgeoned into this enormous assault on his private life, in which you had newspapers claiming that he had been in brawls in saloons and been laying there naked and bleeding while he fought over prostitutes, and ministers denouncing him from the pulpit for having taken the virtue and innocence of all these different young women who all then died of grief and lie there in their graves remembering this horrible man, and so on and so on and so forth.
What were the standards for reporting?
There weren't many. That was in the 1890s, and you were sort of just getting into the period in which you had professional reporters who were serious about their craft, who were somewhat trained and who believed that you should report things that were true. But most of the press was still partisan, and there was a ton of little bitty press. And I think that that's the crucial thing that you have to remember when you're looking at the way the media covers politics and covers the personal lives of presidents. Whenever you have in American history a whole mess of small media competing, not terribly well-funded, not funded at all sometimes, often partisan or having an agenda, sort of all yapping together and running around, you're going to get some very wild accusations. That's the way things were in much of the 19th century, when people don't remember now, of course, but outrageous things were said about the personal lives of major politicians, including the president. And when you have a few pieces of media that are very well funded, that have a lot to lose, that are sort of corporate, that don't really have much competition, that know that their own futures are secure, you tend to be much more discreet and respectful. And that's the situation that we remember from most of the historical lives that people who are alive today can think about. But it's not like that anymore. In many ways, we're much more like the 19th century. We got tons of little stuff out there. And we've got incredible competition. We've got 3-4 all-news TV channels going at the same time in any one market. And a lot of what's happening today has a lot more to do with that technology and that economics than it does to do with any change in our moral fiber or our perceptions of what's appropriate to talk about.
Let me get back to Grover Cleveland. What was the impact of the Cleveland sex scandals on his presidency and on the office of the president.
Grover, I think of him as Grover. He's my very favorite president because his life as president was so outrageous and it's so totally out of keeping with his character, which was very stolid. One of his friends said after that first campaign that the iron had entered into his soul and it stayed there. He was not exactly a fun guy to begin with, but he was even more repressed and sort of resentful. He just hated newspapers. When he did become engaged, he was a bachelor during this whole horrible campaign. And one of the reasons, it's very clear, that he refused to let anybody talk about what was going on was that if he was not the father of the illegitimate child, the person who was probably his dead law partner. And Cleveland was secretly madly in love with the dead law partner's daughter, who was this beautiful 19-year-old girl, while he was this middle-aged, 300-pound, very non-suave governor of New York. And they finally did get married, but he hated the press so much that he wouldn't admit that he was engaged. He wouldn't tell them he was going to get married. He wouldn't tell them who he was going to get married. And many people just presumed it was Frances, the girl's mother, because they would be the right ages together, which made him even more upset. And during his entire presidency, which lasted, he's the only two-term total peacetime Democratic president we've had until we think Bill Clinton. And all during his presidency, he suffered from one set of rumors after another, more outrageous than the other. Once he got married, people said he beat his wife, who he was totally devoted to. Then they said his children were retarded or deformed because when his wife was pregnant, he had beaten her and he had harmed the children. Then they said he was a total alcoholic. The man had not a moment's peace during the entire time he was president.
You know, I think when we talk about the sex life of a public figure, we assume that that talk is gossip. In the case of President Clinton, the nation is fixated on this because of the possibility of perjury. They're fixated on this because...
Well, we're not necessarily.
Well, okay, that's true. Yes, that's right. But you know, officially, the press is focusing on this and American citizens are focusing on this. Because Kenneth Starr is focusing on this, so I'd like you to think out loud for us if this is the first time that a sphere that we always consider gossip, the sex life of a public figure, has become such a kind of
a legal issue.
Legal issue, exactly. Yeah. That we have legal reasons why we want to know if the president had oral sex with somebody.
Well, it does make things easier, doesn't it? I mean, we really can all sit around and say we really don't care about the sex at all. We're only interested in the perjury issue here. That's happened before when in the 70s when we had gone through a period in which, long period in which, the media was totally discreet about the behavior of politicians, about their private lives. We hit a period of incredible scandals about members of Congress. A lot of people remember the Fannie Fox, the Tidal Basin bombshell, the stripper who was involved with the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Wilbur Mills, and you know they were sort of bounding around all over the place. He later admitted that he had been an alcoholic and didn't remember a lot of it. So this has happened before in that context, but we've never had a sitting president who was involved in a public sex scandal that had some official cover that allowed you to talk about it in terms of policy like this before. That part of this is totally new.
My guest is Gail Collins, author of the forthcoming book, Scorpion Tongues, Gossip, Celebrity, and American Politics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gail Collins. She's on the editorial board of the New York Times, and she's the author of the new book, Scorpion Tongues, Gossip, Celebrity, and American Politics. It's scheduled for publication in the spring. The press is now reporting on the sex life of a president, an area that used to be relegated to gossip. Do you think that the press is using the same standards of reporting to report on this, on these sexual allegations, as they've used to report on, say, Watergate, which is a purely political scandal?
It's hard in a way. I noticed reading the news magazines this week that there's a disproportionate number of said a close friend or said people saying very hard, sort of harsh things about Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, and not being named on something like Watergate, on anything normal that we cover, you tend to be a lot more rigorous about when you're going to allow unnamed sources to be in your stories. I think the reason for that is partly that the media is desperate to get a whole bunch of stuff out there, and they're also very well aware that you can very seldom get anybody to talk about someone else's sex life and or private behavior and be quoted. And I mean, this is very sort of tender and sensitive stuff. But the problem with that is whenever you use unnamed sources, whenever you have said a former friend of Monica Lewinsky's, you know, she was always very flaky and, you know, she had this affair with this other guy and yada, yada, yada. Whenever you do that, you know, you're lowering a standard. It's you can't rely on somebody who's unnamed. The reader can't rely on them in the same way they can that somebody who's willing to stand behind what they say. And to that extent, it's getting a little it is getting a little messy out there, I think. But you know, we've gone through this before. That the real famous precedent in that for the media was the Gary Hart case, in which you suddenly had people for the first time doing investigative reporting about a politician's very private life. And that had sort of never come up in that context before in America, where you had the great moral standing of the press.
Do you think that the Gary Hart story led to any new standards of reporting, standards that are still being applied today?
Well, it led to new standards about what gets covered.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. I think that people tried during the Gary Hart period to use the same standards of reporting they did use for Watergate, for a sex affair. And they were pretty careful. They were, if you look back on those clips, boy, they were pretty vigilant about what they wrote and who they quoted and making sure that all of their sources were clean on this thing. And there's a reason, though, you know, that we're doing this now. The reason that it made sense, the reason that the Gary Hart thing was almost inevitable, and a real change that's happened that's put political campaigns in a different context, is that unlike the 19th century, unlike most of the 20th century, right now, regular American voters nominate and elect the president. There's nothing that stands between the regular average voters and the next president of the United States except their own judgment. There are no great wise elders sitting back there going through all of everybody's past history and deciding whether they're appropriate candidates or not. And once the people, the average voters, have the responsibility for screening these guys and these women, then they have a right to know more about them, perhaps, than they did before. And that was in the context in which the Gary Hart issue had. And that's why from now on, I think you're going to often have political campaigns for president in which personal issues come up again and again and again.
Do you think the standards have changed at all for what it takes to turn gossip into a legitimate news item?
That's a good question. And in one way, it hasn't changed at all. Throughout American history, whenever one event happens officially, then other things follow. There's nothing that's happened in terms of the Clinton situation that hasn't happened before. This is all real news. This is all stuff that's happened. This is all things that are happening in a totally public context. What is different is that at this point in history, and it's happened before, but it hasn't happened for a long time, things can be in the news simply because they are rumor. People can say, well, there are rumors going around that Susan McDougall, who is now in jail because she refuses to testify before the special prosecutor. I saw a story in the Post a while ago, in the New York Post, saying Susan McDougall, it is rumor, and everybody's saying Susan McDougall is only staying in jail because she thinks Clinton will marry her, divorce Hillary and marry her once his term is up. Now, they have no proof for that. They don't even pretend to have any proof. They simply want you to know that that's a rumor that's out there. Now, how do we know it's a rumor? We know it's a rumor because somebody told it to somebody else. And that, it's a faux kind of way of doing reporting, because everybody who's a reporter knows that you can start a rumor yourself and get it tossed back to you within a half an hour. If I call somebody up and say, have you heard the rumor that that Bill Clinton is sleeping with X in his cabinet? I can guarantee you, if I call five people and ask them that question, by the end of the day, if I call a sixth person and ask them, they'll tell me that they've heard the rumor because they heard it from one of my first five people. It's one thing you've always got to be really careful about when you're trying to find out whether a rumor is a serious thing or not.
Ted Koppel on Nightline the other night, in the opening words of his broadcast, used the words oral sex. And I think a lot of Americans have been actually quite entertained by hearing all their anchor people using terms like
that's a first.
Like oral sex. Yeah, it certainly is.
And the entire female population of America wants to know where they were in high school when this rule about how oral sex didn't count was being taught. Yes.
That's right. Well, I'm wondering if you and your colleagues at the New York Times are kind of gritting your teeth as you decide what level of explicitness to use in your discussions on the editorial pages.
Not just my colleagues at the New York Times. Although the New York Times is well known to be one of the places that's the least enthusiastic about this kind of reporting and this kind of talk of all the media in the world. But it goes on everywhere right now. Every place where there is media right now, people are trying to discuss how much you can say, you know, how when you talk about oral sex, what that means and how much you can follow that through. But, you know, we talked about before about what gossip teaches people. Everybody knows, or a lot of people know, that there are guys in the world who they have two standards about what's appropriate sexually, the one they use with good girls and the one they use with bad girls. And knowing this kind of stuff about a prominent man is depressing, I'm sure, if it happens to be true for many Americans. But it's also, you do learn stuff about the way the world operates through this kind of gossip, and I'm not sure that it's an entirely bad thing.
What do you mean?
Well, this is not the first time we have had a politician tell us that oral sex doesn't count. This was an issue in the Senate campaign in, how was it, 94, I guess, in which Senator Robb was running against Oliver North. And Senator Robb, as Oliver North's people pointed out on an almost daily or hourly basis when he had been governor, had been going down to Virginia Beach for parties that his wife was not invited to. And that he'd been a real party kind of animal down there for a while. And he denied that he had ever committed adultery. And poked further as the time went on, his aide said, well, he was only talking about oral sex. That didn't count. So we've been down this road before with other politicians. And I find this a very useful piece of information to know as a woman, that there's this theory that's been going around. And then you don't learn these things by, you know, through your normal course of history. You pick this stuff up usually through gossip. Do you not find that useful in your own life to know these things, that there are these double standards that clearly some men are operating under in which these things don't count?
I see your point. It is useful for people to know this. Do you think it's useful for people to know this about their politicians? Do you think it's relevant?
I think it's relevant. If we were having an election, it would be more relevant. We had two elections with Bill Clinton in which people came to know that this was a man who had a very active sexual life, who told us, not voluntarily, but because he had an ex-mistress running around, you know, yelling about it, that he had not had a perfect marriage and that, you know, he wanted people to get past that and talk about his issues and his politics. And people did. And people clearly decided over those two elections that the top thing on their agenda was not having a president who had a perfect history as a faithful husband. Now we're learning a new thing, maybe, if these allegations are true, we're learning that these things don't necessarily stop, that a guy perhaps who had a history like that when he wasn't president will not have a different history when he is president, if this stuff turns out to be true. Now, that's an important thing for people to know, and they have a right to sort of put that into their bank of information when it comes to judging the next president. We worked under the assumption, I think, with Bill Clinton that the stuff that had happened when he was governor, when he was a regular private citizen, would, of course, not happen again when he was president of the United States. Well, now there are serious allegations that, no, it happened. It was just the same. It just kept going on exactly the same as before. Now, that's not trivial information for people to know. And it might be depressing. And at the end, people might simply decide that, as a poll that the Times had today suggests, they might be deciding that, well, yeah, it's terrible and we're really sad, but life goes on and we like his policies.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Gail Collins, for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Gail Collins serves on the editorial board of the New York Times. Her forthcoming book on politics and gossip is called Scorpion Tongues. It will be published in early spring by Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.